This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, May 25th. I'm Evan Osnos, a staff writer at The New Yorker. One of the most prominent members of Donald Trump's cabinet is the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. After 41 years in the Marine Corps, he retired as a four-star general in 2013. And once he was nominated, Congress agreed to waive a federal law requiring military officers to wait 7 years before serving as defense secretary. On January 12th, Mattis testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee and offered a glimpse of the philosophy that would inform his leadership of the armed forces. Senator Gary Peters of Michigan asked the general to elaborate on a passage from a book that Mattis had edited entitled Warriors and Citizens.
Because the American public holds its military in such high regard, we are putting it at greater risk.
Mattis responded,
"We should not simply be turning to the military because it's a very capable military, because it's well led. It's now a national treasure. I'm the first to admit that. But it doesn't mean we should be turning to the military to answer all of our concerns in our relations with the world."
Dexter Filkins, who's overseas at the moment, joins me to discuss James Mattis, his view of the Middle East, and what this will mean for the United States. Dexter, you wrote a profile of Mattis for this week's issue of the magazine. You first encountered him in 2003 when he was a two-star general commanding the 1st Marine Division during the invasion of Iraq. When he was nominated, every news story seemed to mention the fact that his nickname was Mad Dog Mattis. But you write that this really doesn't capture the full picture of him. So how does Mattis differ from what Americans might assume about him?
I think he doesn't even like the nickname. And I canvassed all of his friends, and nobody uses it. They all said he doesn't much like it. So I think it's one of these things that somebody slapped on him somewhere and it stuck, but he didn't exactly wince when I brought it up, but almost. He is way more complicated and way more complex than that nickname would suggest, even if that was the main draw for the president. Mattis is deeply read, very thoughtful. His library is said to contain thousands of books. It's legendary. Everyone talks about it. And when you talk to him about war, about the military, about his job, it's out comes just one literary reference and then another and then another. He grew up without a television set, and his parents encouraged him to read. And so he is just really, really interesting to talk to. So it's this kind of yin-yang. On one hand, you have this very thoughtful guy, and on the other, you have an extremely aggressive military officer, and that's the mad dog part of him. He's known for that extreme aggression.
One of the points that you make in the piece that's very interesting is that it's important to see him as a Marine general, that's something very specific. It's different than being an Army general. How do the Marines see themselves, and why does that matter in understanding what makes James Mattis tick?
I think the Marines are different than the Army. They definitely see themselves as different than the Army. And this is something I'd never had thought of much until I spent some time with the Marines. They're much smaller than the Army. They're much looser. Their equipment is often antiquated and kind of broken down even. But they take a kind of pride in that. They see themselves as this very fit, very Spartan, very trimmed down force that is ready to go anywhere at any time and fight. And they take great pride in that. And I think Mattis symbolizes that. You know, he's not a big man, and he is extremely self-disciplined. He's kind of Spartan in his demeanor. He doesn't have much of a social life. He doesn't drink much. He pushes himself relentlessly. He's very much a Marine when you meet him, even when he's wearing, as he does now, a suit and tie.
Did you ever get the feeling, Dexter, that he is aware of the importance of a public profile in the sense that he sort of has this image of, as the title of your piece conveys, the warrior monk, and at the same time that he has this sort of nickname trailing behind him, whether he likes it or not, of Mad Dog Mattis. Did you form a sense of how alert he was to that media presentation? Does he cultivate it, or is it just sort of incidental to the way he does his work?
He really does not like the attention. He really did not want to cooperate with me. It was very difficult. I think it made him uncomfortable. He said, I don't want to have my face out there. When I told him I was writing a profile of him, he really did recoil. You know, I had to remind him, really. I said, look, you're known across the country. You're the Secretary of Defense. So he's just not comfortable with that kind of attention.
James Mattis has, like any senior member of the military these days, spent much of the last decade in and around the Middle East. He objected to the invasion of Iraq. He didn't think it was a good idea. But then, of course, it became a major part of his professional life. How do you think the last decade in the Middle East, or the period from 2003 to 2013 when he retired, shaped his thinking about the U.S. military and about that part of the world?
Well, first of all, you're right. He's very explicit about that. He said, I was in command of several hundred Marines in Afghanistan in 2002 when I got a telephone call from Washington, and they said, Jim, we're bringing you back to get you ready for the invasion of Iraq. This is a year before the invasion happened. And he said, literally, you've got to be kidding me. And I said, nope, come on back and get ready. And so he just thought, and he thinks that basically we didn't succeed in Afghanistan because the invasion of Iraq took all of our attention and all of our resources. And of course, Iraq has not been a success either. And here we are, you know, more than a decade later in each place, still trying to figure out how to get out. My sense, spending time with him, was that he feels like there was not a sufficient commitment not just a military commitment, but financial and even a kind of intellectual commitment to seeing these conflicts through. So, for instance, he was, I think, violently opposed to President Obama's decision to draw down the American troops at the end of 2011, go to zero, basically. He was absolutely opposed to that. And in Afghanistan, I think his sense is that we've gone down too far there, and we've lost the initiative in those places. I remember General George Casey, who was in Iraq, used to say, if it was easy, we would have done it by now. These things are just intractable by their nature, and I don't think Secretary Mattis has a super clear, well-thought-out plan about how to get out. I think he thinks if we commit more troops and more resources to these places, then we can kind of get a hold of them and then better steer the outcome of events.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about him and his vision of the region, because even as the United States is embroiled in a whole range of at least five armed conflicts at the moment, he is also very focused on what he regards as a risk over the horizon, and that is Iran. Just this past week, Trump was on his first overseas trip as president in Saudi Arabia. He spoke to a crowd of more than 50 Arab and Muslim leaders, and he called for a renewed campaign against extremist groups in the Middle East. But at the end, he also turned to the subject of another enemy.
But no discussion of stamping out this threat would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three: safe harbor, financial backing, and the social standing needed for recruitment. It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in that region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran.
Dexter, in your piece, you explain how General Mattis's position with regards to Iran has really developed over the course of his years in the Middle East. He describes it as the most dangerous actor in the region. He talks about the need to contain Iran in some form, but he doesn't describe it as an easy problem. Talk to us a bit about that. Where did this begin for James Mattis? Why does Iran feature so prominently in his conception of the Middle East?
I think Secretary Mattis is tough on Iran as anybody you can find. His view of Iran was shaped by his experience in Iraq. And in Iraq, the Iranians were mostly covertly, but in full knowledge of the United States, training the Shiite militias that were killing American soldiers, arming them, and in particular giving them these very lethal weapons called explosively formed penetrators. They were a kind of an IED that was particularly deadly, and they killed hundreds of American soldiers. And so I think that enraged General Mattis, and I think he from the beginning has wanted to be more aggressive towards the Iranians. And that view has continued, and it's carried until now. There was a great moment described to me by one of President Obama's aides in 2011 when General Mattis, then the commander of CENTCOM, which is all forces in the Middle East, came to the Oval Office to meet President Obama. And President Obama said, well, what are your priorities? And General Mattis replied, I have three, Iran, Iran, and Iran. And I think that sums it up pretty well. I think that made the Obama administration very uncomfortable. In 2012, the Obama administration embarked on secret negotiations with the Iranian government, which were taking place in Oman. And these were the prelude to the negotiations to curtail their nuclear weapons program. I think General Mattis was aware of those discussions, but his focus was on what the Iranians were doing in the region. And that meant everything from supporting Hezbollah to causing trouble in the Persian Gulf to supporting Shiite militias inside Iraq. And so throughout this period, so on one hand, you have the United States negotiating with the Iranians, and General Mattis pushed the Obama White House continuously over time to be more aggressive towards the Iranians. So he was coming up with options all the time. Give me the authority to attack Iranian ships if they begin to lay mine in the Persian Gulf. Give me the authority to shoot down their airplanes if they attack our drones. And this made the White House deeply uncomfortable, and especially as the discussions with the Iranians began to bear fruit. And so in 2013, they announced unceremoniously, I should say, that General Mattis would be retiring before his term was up. He still had 5 months to go. And I think it was done in a particularly brusque way. He didn't forget it, but basically, as several former assistants to President Obama said to me, we just decided that it was too risky, that we were trying to do this deal with the Iranians, and he was pushing really hard, and we didn't want to knock the apple cart over. And so we thought it was better just to bring in somebody else.
So he now works for a president who is much more amenable to the idea of confrontation with Iran. I'm trying to square these two pieces of Secretary Mattis's view of the world. On the one hand, he's concerned about overextending American force, relying too hard on the military when it puts too much of a burden on fighting men and women. And at the same time, he is, as he puts it, preparing for a future with Iran that could be, the word he used once in a speech was ghastly. He said, it's not going to be pleasant for any of us. Did you come to a view, Dex, on how he manages these two competing concerns? On the one hand, Iran. On the other hand, the overapplication of American force.
Secretary Mattis is very clear on the subject of military force and diplomacy. He says when you're conducting a foreign policy, military force is not enough. And when he was testifying in front of Congress, he said, look, if you're going to cut the budget for the State Department, ultimately I'm going to have to buy more bullets. Don't ask me to do too much. And yet, on the other hand, he's really, really aggressive, and particularly towards Iran. And then if you couple that with what I think is really the kind of the inactivity of the State Department and of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson so far, you end up with a foreign policy that I think is probably overbalanced on one side, and that is the military side. I mean, so you have Secretary Mattis, he's very dynamic, he's very aggressive, his budget is growing, and on the other hand, you have Secretary of State Tillerson, who's pretty quiet so far. His budget's being cut. The State Department is pretty demoralized by most accounts. And I think where you end up with that is potentially a couple of confrontations. And one of those potentially is with Iran. And I think what may happen here, and it may not, but it's very easy to envision, will be if Congress decides, as they may, to impose more stiff sanctions on Iran for their ballistic missile program, then you could have the Iranians responding in some way, like either pulling out of the nuclear agreement or doing something in the region. And then things could, I think, pretty rapidly escalate. And I'm worried about that. I mean, I think that that's pretty easy to see in the future. And I think, now this is me talking and not Secretary Mattis. My sense is that Secretary Mattis is probably a little frustrated with the diplomatic side of the United States government. I think that he would like to see a more muscular and vigorous State Department than the one that we have right now. But he's going to do what he's going to do, and his job is to use the military, and he will do that. And so I think it's that imbalance that causes some concern.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You know, Dex, you've covered the region in one form or another for more than a decade now. You were there in Afghanistan before the war in Iraq. You then covered the war in Iraq for many years. As you look at the arrangement of interests and objectives inside this administration, and you think about the lay of the land in the region today, do you get the feeling that we are sort of entering a process that could lead towards war with Iran, or is it too early to be talking about that?
I'm worried about the possibility of a confrontation with Iran. The people, whether it's H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, and Secretary Mattis, Secretary of Defense, these are very steady hands. They're very sober people. They're not reckless at all. And I would, you know, contrast that, I think, with some of the people who are in the White House and the chaos that we've seen coming out of the White House and frankly, the lack of knowledge about foreign affairs that we've seen from some of the people in the White House. And that should make us all a little bit uneasy. And it's a little too easy to envision a crisis with a country like Iran or like North Korea or even like Russia getting out of control. If one of those countries were to do something that was unpredictable, it's a little bit too easy to imagine how things could spin out of control. I think less because of Secretary Mattis or, say, the National Security Advisor McMaster than for some of the more volatile personalities in the White House.
One of the unusual facts about this moment in American politics is that many people talk about the members of the administration who were formerly in uniform, people like General Mattis or H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, as being the ones who may exert a modulating influence on Donald Trump's instinct towards the use of force, that they may be the ones, in fact, who are the greatest bulwarks against extending American power overseas. What do you think about that? Is that hope misplaced, or are people right to imagine that perhaps those figures are going to be have an effect on this administration that others cannot?
When I started working on this story a couple of months ago, any number of people said to me, "I'm so happy that Secretary Mattis is in the place that he is because he'll be the sort of sober guiding force in our foreign policy and defense policy up against the kind of more volatile people in the White House." Secretary Mattis, H.R. McMaster, these are people who have been sobered by the brutalities of war. And I think what I found is something slightly different, particularly in the case of Secretary Mattis, which is what's happened in the White House is they've essentially turned to Mattis and said, you do this. You understand foreign affairs. You understand the use of force. Take it and run with it. And so what they've done is they've taken a lot of the authorities that under the Obama White House had been literally inside the White House, decisions that were being made, whether to launch a SEAL raid, whether to launch an airstrike or a drone strike, decisions that under President Obama were being made in the Oval Office or the West Wing, and they pushed those down to the Pentagon and then out into to the commanders in the field, and that's given them much more authority and much more latitude to conduct military strikes. And so I think the picture that we're getting is like it now is something slightly different. I think the military, and I would include Secretary Mattis in this, they've been itching for that authority. They want this. They've wanted it for a long time. Give us back our authorities to make decisions about when to use force. And President Trump has basically said, go to it. I trust you. And so that's more complicated than what I thought it was initially, which is the volatile White House and the sober generals.
Thank you, Dexter. Dexter Filkins is a staff writer and the author of The Forever War. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Jill Duboff for newyorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Evan Osnos.